Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand and Pete Musto. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, thanks to an effective vaccine, the polio virus has disappeared from most of the world. But a few cases remain in areas that are among the most difficult to reach. To eradicate the virus completely, medical teams are trying to vaccinate children in three countries. The wild polio virus still exists in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Nigeria. But unrest, conflict, and the extreme remoteness of these areas has kept thousands of children from receiving polio vaccines this year. Andrew Etzano works as an immunization expert for the Red Cross. He says that one of the difficulties the group faces is how often people in these areas move. They often flee economic problems, political situations, or violence. Etzano says that as a result, people take the virus from one place to another. And medical teams cannot always track the migrants in order to vaccinate the children. Dr. John Vertefe is with the U.S. government's Health Protection Agency, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He says the CDC uses technology to track migrant groups. Researchers look at images from satellites for clues. Structures that have been repaired and roads without grass growing on them may show researchers that people are living nearby. But when it comes to actually vaccinating people, experts note that local teams are best. Such teams are likely to be aware of an area's culture and customs. For example, in many places, women vaccinate people because they can go into homes, talk to other women, and gain access to the children. In other places, soldiers vaccinate children when they take over an area run by anti-government forces. But these vaccination teams have to move quickly during short breaks in the fighting. They also have to deliver several doses of the vaccine in a short period of time. Even when teams are not providing vaccinations, community volunteers can warn health officials of a polio outbreak. Some volunteers have mobile phones to report if any child becomes unable to use their arms or legs. The goal is to vaccinate everyone before the virus has a chance to change, making the existing vaccines less effective. Efforts to end polio completely have been largely effective. Since 1988, when the Global Polio Eradication Program began, the number of polio cases has dropped by 99.9%. In 2017, only 22 people were reported to be crippled by the disease, says the World Health Organization. But the program's success has introduced new problems. Financial supporters, leaders, health workers, and the public are tired of dealing with the problem, especially those who have never seen polio. John Vertefe said, "The last mile is a complicated mile. But he and other experts warn if polio continues to exist anywhere, it could once again spread.
A debate over identity is playing out over a people most Americans have never even heard about. The group are called Métis, a French word for mixed. They are the descendants of French animal trappers and native women during the 1600s in today's Western Canada. In time, the children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren of these couples married each other. Métis developed their own language, their own music, their own style of clothes, and their own kind of food. In other words, they developed their own culture. By the early 1800s, the Métis had created a new political identity, too. It was centered in a colony in the present-day Canadian province of Manitoba. But some established settlements in the United States, too. After the U.S. and Canada settled their borders, many American Métis were grouped with other Native people and ended up on Indian reservations. Over time, some families have kept their Métis identity and culture. Others have lost it completely. In Canada, the government officially recognized Métis in 1982 as one of three Aboriginal groups. They received the same hunting, fishing, and land use rights as the First Nation and the Inuit. But these days, a record number of people are claiming Métis identity, both in Canada and the U.S. Many of these claims, said anthropologist Cade Ferris, are not true. He said some use the word Métis to mean they are mixed race, native and non-native. But, he said, the term really describes being part of a particular culture or nation. Others are only looking to use the tax breaks and land use rights given to the real Métis, say members of the Métis National Council. In 2017, the Canadian government signed a nation-to-nation agreement with the Métis Nation and has promised $516 million over 10 years to support housing, health, and educational needs. In the U.S., Métis are working to relearn their language, Meshif, and continue to celebrate their history and culture in festivals and other events. But they are not trying to gain independent recognition. Roslyn Lapierre is a Métis writer and member of the Blackfoot Nation in Montana. She said separating Métis from Chippewa or Cree would be impossible because their cultures are so combined. But we know who we are, she added. I'm Susan Shand. Thank you.
There have been many improvements in how weather experts predict the path of hurricanes, powerful storms that form in the ocean. However, forecasters still struggle when trying to estimate one quality of a coming storm, its intensity. Intensity measurements would help people prepare for flooding and deadly winds like those of Hurricane Maria last year. Maria killed an estimated 4,465 people, severely damaged the electrical power system, and caused $90 billion in damage in Puerto Rico. Steve Bowen is the director and weather expert for the insurance company Aon Benfield's impact forecasting team. He said it is helpful to know where a hurricane is going, but more information about its intensity is needed. We sort of have half the circle filled in, and we need to get that other half filled in, Bowen told the Reuters News Service. Some climate scientists have said that warming sea and air temperatures have added more energy to the storms, and this might affect intensity predictions. Kerry Emanuel is a climate professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. In a recent academic paper, he wrote, "Climate change potentially affects the frequency, intensity, and tracks of hurricanes and other similar storms." In 2017, the U.S. government's National Hurricane Center reported that it had failed to correctly predict the sudden intensification of the 2016 hurricane called Matthew. That storm strengthened very quickly, with winds reaching up to 270 kilometers per hour. It caused major destruction in the Caribbean, including killing more than 1,000 people in Haiti, according to Reuters. Scientists say there are several scientific models for predicting hurricane intensity, but they are all of limited use. The current science of tracking a storm's path depends heavily on information about conditions on its edges. But intensity is based on what is happening in the middle of it. Generally, measurements are taken one of three ways. Sometimes researchers fly a Hurricane Hunter aircraft into the storm. Other times, they use a device called a weather buoy to measure wind speeds as a storm passes over. Or they get information from satellites. One project to gather more information to predict intensity is the Cyclone Global Navigation Satellite System, or CYGNSS for short. CYGNSS is a group of 8 low-orbit satellites. The American space agency NASA launched it in 2016. Earlier satellites had trouble measuring ocean surface winds at the center of storms. Heavy rain at the center often weakened their signals, NASA officials said. Christopher Ruff is a lead investigator with CYGNSS and a climate science professor at the University of Michigan. He noted, "For storms that are changing really quickly, you could miss something like rapid intensification." NASA designed CYGNSS to measure surface winds in and near the center of tropical storm systems. Researchers said that having more satellites means they can pass over the storms more often. And the low-orbit satellites are closer to the storms, so experts get more real-time information to use for predicting intensity. At present, researchers are focusing on the 2017 season when hurricanes severely affected Texas, Florida, and Puerto Rico. storms caused hundreds of billions of dollars in damage. And researchers are re-examining information gathered from Cygnus to see how it affected the quality of the forecasts and how it can be better used to predict intensity. Cygnus could be fully operational next year, researchers said. I'm Pete Musto.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. The House of Representatives ended the day's business early on the rainy afternoon of April 12, 1945. The House Democratic leader, Speaker Sam Rayburn, invited a friend to come by his office for a drink. "Be there around 5," Rayburn said. "Harry Truman is coming over." Harry Truman was the vice president at the time. The events are described in a book about his presidency, Conflict and Crisis, by Robert Donovan. World War II was not over yet, but it was a quiet afternoon in Washington. President Franklin Roosevelt was in the southern state of Georgia. He was resting after his recent trip to Yalta to meet with British Prime Minister Winston Churchill and Soviet leader Joseph Stalin. The president's wife, Eleanor, was at the White House working on a speech supporting the new United Nations. Harry Truman was at the Senate, but he was not interested in the debate that was taking place. He spent most of his time writing to his family back in Missouri. When the debate finished, he went to the office of House Leader Rayburn to join him for a drink. It was an afternoon Truman would never forget. Rayburn and his friend were talking in the office before Truman arrived. The telephone rang. It was a call from the White House asking whether the vice president had arrived yet. "No," Rayburn replied. The caller asked him to have Truman telephone the White House as soon as he arrived. Truman entered a minute later. He immediately called the White House. As he talked, his face became white. He put down the phone and raced out the door to his car. Truman arrived at the White House within minutes. An assistant took him up to the president's private living area. Eleanor Roosevelt was waiting for him there. "Harry," she said, "the president is dead." Truman was shocked. He asked Mrs. Roosevelt if there was anything he could do to help her. But her reply made clear to him that his own life had suddenly changed. "Is there anything we can do for you?" Mrs. Roosevelt asked the new president. "You are the one in trouble now." Within hours, the world learned the news that Franklin Roosevelt, the longest-serving president in American history, was dead. He died of a cerebral hemorrhage, bleeding in the brain. Americans were shocked and scared. It was 1945, and the United States was still at war. Roosevelt had led the nation since early 1933. He was the only president many young Americans had ever known. Who would lead them now? All eyes turned to Harry Truman.
"Our departed leader never looked backward. He looked forward and moved forward. That is what he would want us to do. That is what America will do."
Harry Truman in his first speech to Congress as president.
"With great humility, I call upon all Americans to help me keep our nation united in defense of those ideals which have been so eloquently proclaimed by Franklin Roosevelt." I want, in turn, to assure my fellow Americans and all of those who love peace and liberty throughout the world that I will support and defend those ideals with all my strength and all my heart.
Truman had been a surprise choice for vice president at the Democratic Party nominating convention in 1944. Delegates considered several other candidates before they chose him as Roosevelt's running mate. That was at a time when presidential candidates did not make their own choices for vice president. Harry Truman lacked the fame, the rich family, and the strong speech-making skills of Franklin Roosevelt. He was a much simpler man. He grew up in the Midwestern state of Missouri. Truman only studied through high school, but took some nighttime law school classes. He worked for many years as a farmer and a small businessman, but without much success. Truman had long been interested in politics. When he was almost 40, he finally won several low-level positions in his home state. By 1934, he was popular enough in Missouri to be nominated and elected to the United States Senate. And he won re-election 6 years later. Most Americans, however, knew little about Harry Truman when he became president. They knew he had close ties to the Democratic Party political machine in his home state. But they had also heard that he was a very honest man. They could see that Truman had strongly supported President Roosevelt's New Deal programs. But they could not be sure what kind of president Truman would become. History gave Truman little time to learn about his new job. The most important power he now possessed was the power of atomic weapons. And soon after he became president, he faced the decision of whether or not to use that power for the first time in history. Truman firmly believed that using the atomic bomb was the only way to force Japan to surrender. So in August of 1945, he gave the orders to drop the atomic bombs on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Having found the atomic bomb, we have used it. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war. Only a Japanese surrender will stop us. It is an awful responsibility which has come to us. We thank God that it has come to us instead of to our enemies. And we pray that he may guide us to use it in his ways and for his purposes.
Days earlier, Truman had met in Potsdam, Germany, near Berlin, with the British and Soviet leaders, Winston Churchill and Joseph Stalin, to plan the peace. The war in Europe had ended several months before.
Good evening from the White House in Washington. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My fellow Americans, I have just returned from Berlin, the city from which the Germans intended to rule the world. It is a ghost city. The buildings are in ruins. Its economy and its people are in ruins. Our party also visited what is left of Frankfurt and Darmstadt. We flew over the remains of Kessel, Magdeburg, and other devastated cities. German women and children and old men were wandering over the highways, returning to bombed-out homes or leaving bombed-out cities, searching for food and shelter. War has indeed come home to Germany and to the German people. It has come home in all the frightfulness with which the German leaders started and waged it.
The three leaders agreed that their nations and France would jointly occupy Germany. They also agreed to end the Nazi Party in Germany to hold trials for Nazi war criminals, and to break up some German businesses. Foreign ministers of the Allied nations later negotiated peace treaties with Germany and other countries, including Italy, Hungary, and Romania. Eastern European nations agreed to protect the political and economic freedom of their citizens. However, Western political experts were increasingly worried that the Soviet Union would block any effort for real democracy in Eastern Europe. Truman did not trust the Soviets, and as he made plans for post-war Asia, he promised himself that he would not allow Moscow any part in controlling Japan. The leader of the American occupation in Japan was Army General Douglas MacArthur. MacArthur acted quickly to hold a series of trials for Japanese war crimes. He also launched a series of reforms to move Japan toward becoming more like a Western democracy. Women were given the right to vote. Land was divided among farmers. The idea of a national religion was ended, and the educational system was reorganized. Japan began to recover, becoming stronger than ever as an economic power. Truman and other world leaders were dealing with the problems of making peace, but at the same time, they were also trying to establish a new system for keeping the peace. The United States, the Soviet Union, Britain, and the other allies had formed the United Nations during wartime. But soon after Truman took office, they met in San Francisco to discuss ways to make the United Nations a permanent organization for peace. In July of 1944, many of the world's top economic experts met to organize a new system for the world economy. They gathered at a hotel in Bretton Woods in the American state of New Hampshire. They created the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to help nations rebuild their economies. At the center of all the action was Harry Truman. It was not long before he showed Americans and the world that he had the ability to be a good president. He was honest, strong, and willing to make decisions. I was sworn in one night, and the next morning I had to get right to the job at hand, Truman remembered years later. In an oral history recorded with the writer Merle Miller, Truman said, "I was afraid, but of course I didn't let anybody know that. And I knew that I would not be called on to do anything that I was not able to do. That's something I learned from reading history." Truman spoke of how people in the past had much bigger problems. Somehow, he said, the best of them just went ahead and did what they had to do. And they usually did all right.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.